From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Noe Valley, San Francisco.
DuBose Triangle, Lower Haight.
Visitation Valley.
Downtown San Francisco.
Oh, Ingleside, SF.
Coming up, we find out why local monument makers dedicate themselves to setting the lives of our loved ones in stone.
When I work, I don't need food. I don't need water, I don't need anything.
Then we hear about a new play based on the true story of a journalist investigating the crack cocaine epidemic.
We have either decided or have been told that crack is about lunatics taking drugs and going insane.
And we go to church to learn the story behind this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound. It's music to our ears today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Death is a universal experience, but how we memorialize loss varies across cultural traditions. Here in the Bay Area, the diversity and artistic spirit that characterizes life here holds true in death as well. Just ask local monument makers like Chris Veerhaus, who runs American Monumental in Colma.
We do, you know, Armenian, a Persian percentage. There's Catholic. There's a Japanese cemetery up there where it's Japanese only. There are four Jewish cemeteries in town. You have to know how to do Cyrillic to engrave Asian, Korean. There's a Korean section.
So how do local monument makers blend artistry with an understanding of the varied cultures here to capture the lives of our loved ones in stone? KALW's Melanie Young visited some to find out.
Judy Left stands in the early morning sun at the Hills of Eternity Jewish Cemetery in Colma. It's a beautiful park-like setting. The graves bear a mix of English and Hebrew inscriptions. Little stones rest on the tops of many of the memorials.
And that's a Jewish tradition. You put a stone on top of the grave to show I was here.
Left lost her father, Henry, in 2007, and her mother, Sylvia, in 2010. But in some ways, they're still a part of her life.
I come out here all the time, just because I love the cemetery, and I miss my parents.
In their day, Left's parents were well-known actors and educators, and when they passed, she was left to ask,
"How do you say that in a stone?"
That's a question many eventually face. When someone we love dies, how can a headstone express who they were? The answer begins with diamonds. Inside the American Monumental Company in Colma, foreman Richard Bortoli lowers a circular saw onto a slab of granite.
There's little diamond, really small diamonds in there.
Oh, because diamond is so hard,
yeah.
It can cut
yeah.
through the granite.
As he cuts, the stone begins to shimmer. He maneuvers a saw along a wooden pattern to create a custom top for the headstone. Chris Veerhaus, owner of American Monumental, says they have designs for everyone, practically.
As the Filipino and Latin American community has become more established in our area, you see a lot more, you know, Our Lady of Guadalupe's and the Virgin Mary's. The Asian designs are a lot of times as the little bamboos and the little pagodas and phoenix and dragons.
Veerhaus has kind of developed into a cultural anthropologist.
You learn a lot of different cultures. You learn a lot of different religions and hear a lot of stories here.
Sometimes he even knows more than his clients, so they turn to him for guidance.
I mean, many of the families, they're second generation. They're not aware of certain cultural or ethnic kind of things. Like, for instance, I've had a Mexican-American family come in here, and they really like this one cross. And I have to point out, you know what? That's a Celtic cross. I don't think that's the right cross for you, you know, because it looked really neat. But it's really an Irish Catholic cross. And then they go, wow, I wouldn't even have known that. You know, thanks.
Sometimes clients need help, but sometimes they yearn for what they already know. Art in Stone, another monument shop in Colma, started out by filling one culture's particular need.
The Russian Jewish community.
That's Michael Radar. His father, Leon, opened Art in Stone in the 80s, during a wave of Russian immigration.
They were accustomed to what they saw back in their homeland, and they didn't have anybody here to manufacture it for them.
Michael's father, Leon, learned his craft in the Soviet Union.
I came to work with artistry when I was 14 years old. Step by step, I learned working, drawing.
And what Leon Radar mastered was the very distinctive Russian style. If you go to the Russian section of the Jewish cemetery, it feels a little like you've entered a fairy tale. Huge granite sculptures rise up to represent the dead. Some take the form of a loved one's passion, a life-sized guitar or grand piano for a musician, a winding strip of film for a photographer. For many years, Radar also hand-etched images into granite. Much like creating a tattoo, he would use a needle and etch in each dot. The work was slow and painstaking, but he didn't mind.
Oh, I love it. When I work, I don't need food, I don't need water, I don't need anything. I'm just full in this work.
Today, Leon Rader's son, Michael, says computers have changed all that.
We have a different technique now. It's also etched in stone, but it's half computerized, half sandblasted.
In a way, the process transforms granite into a photographer's lens. Families can design much more intricate and realistic imagery for their loved ones.
And what we did for a young kid, used to race with his father, loved baseball, loved the Giants. And this is what you should see for a loved one, something that brings you back to the good times.
So it's got him in his baseball gear and picture.
The boy beams out from under his baseball cap, the former Pac Bell Stadium behind him. To the right, he and his father sit astride a race car. They hold a winner's trophy. Monuments today can showcase both cultural traditions and the very personal. What's more, Radar says designing a monument can help families heal, but he says the timing needs to be right.
Actually, sometimes when I have families come in, like directly after a funeral or within a week, I send them on their way. Because I'm a big believer, if you design a memorial when you're in grief, every time you're going to come back to that monument, you're going to come back to that grief, to that pain. So I always tell them, go home, come back in 6 months. 6 months, 7 months. You need to design this with a straight head, and then they're always happy with the final design.
Back at the Hills of Eternity Cemetery, Judy Leff says she took the time she needed to design her parents' monument. Performing was a huge part of her parents' lives.
So I put the Hollywood Walk of Fame signs on here, the comedy tragedy mask, the radio microphone, TV screen, and the film. My husband actually drew them, and then the monument maker was able to inscribe them into the stone. And then the expression, "All the world's a stage."
Leff says, in Jewish tradition, families hold a monument unveiling ceremony 1 year after a loved one has passed.
When I first saw it, I knew, that's it. That's it. That's what I wanted. That's what Dad would want. That's what they would want.
Memorials vary across culture and also time. Recent trends include environmentally friendly headstones made of plant materials and interactive stones that link visitors to a website. While memorials continue to evolve, the impulse to honor and cherish a loved one remains everlasting. In Colma, I'm Melanie Young for Cross Currents.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Marijuana has now been decriminalized in 27 states. America spent $1 trillion in the war on drugs over the past 30 years. And though marijuana has been significantly decriminalized recently, other drugs have not. And while the public was encouraged to just say no, it turns out the government was actually helping fund illegal drug trafficking into the U.S. In 1996, Bay Area journalist Gary Webb wrote an expose in the San Jose Mercury News, proving that in the 1980s, the CIA and DEA helped facilitate drug trafficking into the U.S. to give Nicaraguan Contra fighters funding to topple the communist Sandinista government. 8 years later, Webb was found dead from a gunshot to the head. Officials called it suicide, but the circumstances of his death remain murky. Webb wrote about how that drug trade helped to fuel a crack epidemic in Los Angeles. His articles were compiled into a book entitled Dark Alliance. And that book helped inspire Superheroes, a play at the Cutting Ball Theater in San Francisco. Playwright and director Sean San Jose joined me in studio to talk about how he translated the story for the stage. So let's go to the plot. Tell me the story of the play.
Taking this information about this horrible connection of the influx of crack cocaine into very specific black and brown communities and how it has continued to affect human lives and the toll it has on, without overstating, generations, neighborhoods, families are forever devastated by it. So we try and balance both seeing the seeds of this beginning, but really trying to see what havoc has been wreaked on these people's lives, our lives. I'm mainly always thinking about the two epidemics that we're living and dying through, AIDS and crack, and like, how do you do something that is both responsive, but also maybe helps or furthers a dialogue? And there's a certain part of me that is too emotional, and that my response isn't necessarily productive in a public forum, in a performance forum. And so I think figuring that part out was important for me. And again, like having this seed of inspiration from a journalist helped me go, right, you need to keep an eye on looking and presenting the situation as opposed to telling us how to feel.
So let's hear a scene from your play. And this is Free's scene with Aparecida in the prison when he talks about Doug Williams and Warren Moon and choosing a hero. Let's hear it.
Nah, first black quarterback in the Super Bowl to win the damn thing. Amazing. He did it because he was great. He was fast. He was slick. Doug Williams. You see, somebody's got to be the ball guy. Sure, he's a winner, baby, but if he loses one after the Super Bowl, he gotta deal with the losses, the life losses, being the first.
First what, though?
The first to get over in this game like a businessman.
That's a scene from Superheroes, the latest play by my guest, Sean San Jose. Sean, so can you explain what was happening in that scene?
Yeah, that's a scene between the journalist Aparecida and a character named Free. He chose the shining star, the immediate gratification, rather than thinking more thoroughly through it. And I think it's a way of looking back at this. I mean, we're talking, 30 years now since this epidemic has exploded, and trying, if you can, look back in retrospect and say, had I done left or had I done right, would this have been different for me? And then with someone like that, when their choices affected so many lives. And just also the way that I think the media mainly, and then therefore secondarily us in society, just swallowed those stories whole.
And such a vast amount of drugs could be what? Smuggled in any neighborhood? Under the noses of the so-called community leaders, sheriff's departments, police, not even to say the FBI's, DEAs, and all other law enforcement that show up for everything else? Is it?
So let's talk about the character of Aparecida, played by Delina Patrice Brooks. So the original character obviously is a man, but you changed it to a woman. Why was that?
Well, yeah, I mean, the character of Aparecida, that I wanted to take the reality that I couldn't write about Gary Webb, I couldn't write as Gary Webb, and the sad truth that Gary Webb was, suicided. So he is also a ghost. And so the idea that it could be something different was important to me.
It's clear why I'm here. You should see and hear. I'm a ghost making a case. Flash. I appear. My pen name, Aparecida.
And the name Superheroes?
You would have to be some sort of superhero to withstand and endure this thing.
Crazy superhuman flying high, like take to the clouds, like defying bullets, like superheroes.
You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. And now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's Audiograph's Julie Kane to bring you the answer to this week's mystery sound.
This week's sound is a really special one. Do you want to listen?
There's a divinity in that sound today, and the music really does have the power to speak to you. I had the music talk to me, and man, I know what I'm talking about.
So we asked you what that was and where you think we recorded it. And to bring you the answer, we sent KALW's Christina Loring to church.
I noticed the usual fare, a table with a Bible and sacraments. But on the wall to the left of that is something you won't see in any other church. A floor-to-ceiling painting of John Coltrane holding a scripture in one hand and a saxophone in the other, with a glowing gold halo around his head. This holy Coltrane watches over a cluster of 30 churchgoers. They're a mix of jazz tourists from abroad and local regulars, all clutching tambourines, maracas, and mini hand drums. A ritual jam session begins. The church calls it the Coltrane Liturgy. This means taking the Lord's Prayer and readings from the Gospel and lacing them with their fiery performances of Coltrane's compositions. The small congregation is on its feet, led by a three-woman chorus leaning into their mics with their hands raised to the heavens. The Church of John Coltrane has always put the man's music at the center of its services.
I hear John Coltrane say, you know, when you discover the possibilities of music, you want to help humanity, you want to help free people from their hang-ups and make the world a better place. And so that's the kind of intention that he had behind his music.
That's Wanika King Stevens. Her father, Franzo King, founded the church decades ago after he took his wife, Marina, to see Coltrane play. San Francisco was a hotbed for jazz at the time, packed with smoke-filled clubs and a rotating cast of musical greats. The Kings were at a popular club on the Fillmore, the Jazz Workshop. That night, Franzo King experienced what he calls his sound baptism.
Going to see Train, you had great expectations in the first place. But I think that the most obvious thing that I can remember is the atmosphere around his being. There was something very obviously different about John's walk, his presence. I couldn't liken him to nothing other than a Pentecostal preacher. I like to say it was like being caught up in a rainstorm. We didn't know if it was going to bring flowers or floods, but it brought both. You know, it flooded our heart with the divine love of God, and it planted seeds that grew into what we now call the St. John Coltrane Church.
John Coltrane wasn't always a saint. He was born in 1926 to a North Carolina family of musicians and ministers. He picked up the clarinet and then the tenor sax. After high school, he joined the Navy and made his first recording. He eventually moved to New York, where he played with jazz greats Jimmy Heath, Dizzy Gillespie, and Miles Davis. But as Coltrane hit his musical stride, he also developed a heroin addiction. He was falling asleep at shows. Davis fired him. Coltrane saw this as a wake-up call. The year was 1957. He retreated to his mother's house for a few weeks. Something of a jazz scene cleanse. And he had a realization of a deeper philosophy, as shared in this interview, recorded in Japan in 1966.
I believe that our men are to, are here to grow themselves into the best good that they can be. At least this is what I want to do. And, you know, when I, as I'm going there, becoming this, and when I become, if I ever become, it, this will just come out of the horn. So whatever it's gonna, whatever that's going to be, that's what it will be. Good can only bring good.
Coltrane changed the way the Kings thought about music. He transformed jazz into spiritual enlightenment. Franzo King was sitting in Marcus Bookstore in the Fillmore in 1967 when he learned of Coltrane's passing. It was another awakening for him. It was time to act. The Kings had a listening club, a place to meditate on music. They studied Coltrane's sound and how it related to scripture.
We saw ourselves as the prayerful vigilantes coming together at midnight to listen to St. John's music and be prayerful.
The congregants began considering themselves a church, and the cornerstone would be Coltrane's album, A Love Supreme.
So we played that story for you because this is the 50th anniversary of the recording of A Love Supreme. And there's even a special mass for St. John Coltrane at Grace Cathedral on Monday. To find out more about that, you can go to our website, kalw.org, and click on Audiograph. And I want to tell you about the winner this week. There were a lot of people that knew exactly where we recorded this and what it was. We can only have one winner, and this week that is Felix Odette. Congratulations, Felix! We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt, and for everybody else, you'll have another chance to win next week. We're going to play you a sneak listen of our newest Audiograph mystery sound.
These hydrangeas are all local. These come from, some come from the Half Moon Bay area, and some come from the Eureka area. And then these are all eucalyptuses, different kinds of eucalyptus. This is a yuc, that's a yuc, that's a yuc, that's a yuc, that's a yuc.
Okay, you think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Give us a call at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. We will tell you the story behind the sound next Thursday on Cross Currents. Thanks for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Well, you've heard from us. Now we'd love to hear from you. Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW or call us at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling,
Sandia Dirks,
Rachel Dornhelm,
Hannah Kingsley Ma,
Ashley Ann Krigbaum,
Ted Muldoon,
Judy Silber,
Raja Shah,
Todd Whitney,
and Seth Samuel.
Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff.
Today's line producer was Nina Gensler-Debs.
Our managing editor is Jen Chien.
Our managing producer is Julie Kane.
Ben Trefney is our news director.
Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this music is by the San Francisco Bach Choir. They'll be performing on Saturday at 8 p.m. and Sunday at 4 p.m. at the Cavalry Presbyterian Church in San Francisco. And all the details are at kalw.org. Click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba. And just for sure.